Dr. Charles Baker, who's a personal friend, who is a longtime Confederate, lover of good literature, especially good Southern literature. He's the pastor of Center Point Independent Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And everything we do conservative in Alabama, he prays over it. He is the chaplain of a number of organizations that I'm a member of, and prays over the proceedings. He is has been the chaplain-in-chief of the Sons of Confederate Veterans for a number of years, and has been a state commander of the Tennessee Division of Sons of Confederate Veterans, has founded a SCV camp, has been the commander of a number of SCV camps, and is going to be speaking on John C. Calhoun today, and that great South Carolinian. So Charles, yeah, has
kind of show all these defenders anyway.
I think he has CSA on the bottom of his shoes.
Thank you, my dear brother. What a wonderful morning it has been. Yes. Miss Jackie, didn't she do so splendidly? And then, of course, Brother Rumberg always does splendidly. We expect him to do splendidly. He's my dear friend. I met him years ago at a book sale in Samford University. We both were there early, hoping to be the first ones in, and got to talking and have become good friends. He's my dear brother in the Lord. He has done more to help bring me to the doctrines of grace than any other single individual. I was well on my road there. I made the mistake, as some would say, of several years ago, of deciding that I was going to preach through a book at a time in the Scriptures, rather than just choosing topics from one Sunday or another, or doing a series, that I would start preaching through the Bible. And I know that's not the only way to preach through a book at a time, but it is one way. But it's rather dangerous. It makes you deal with those passages that you used to jump over and that you chose to ignore because they didn't fit your particular system of theology. You know, we're guilty of taking our system and trying to impose it upon the Word rather than letting the Word direct our theology. And I was well on my road down to a Calvinistic position before I met Ron, but he has helped me. He's been so patient. He's such a kind and gentle man that he puts up with somebody as ignorant as I and doesn't make them feel so ignorant. When he first began to talk about the doctrines of grace, it sort of irritated him a little bit. I thought, well, what do you think I've been preaching? But now I understand what he's talking about. You fellas still throw around some terms that I didn't learn at Bob Jones, but... But I'm not so ashamed of my ignorance, but what I'll say, well, what do you mean by that? And try to learn as we go along. Well, a year ago when Brother Sprinkle, and I want to add my appreciation to he and Miss Sprinkle for hosting this. Unless you've done something like this, you don't know how much work is involved. A tremendous lot, and I hope you will express your appreciation to the Sprinkles. They didn't have to do it, but they did do it, and I'm glad they're going to do it again next year, Lord willing. I'm glad to have had a little part in it. Glad to be able to bring my books. I had them in Richmond, and I brought them by. I started that years ago as a service, trying to get people to read about their heritage. All I can do is sell you the book. You're going to have to read it and digest it and make it a part of your thinking, and I hope you will do so as you read good books on the South by Southern men. Like all men's books, you've got to do some sorting in almost any book. It's not inspired of the Word of God, but as far as I know, all the books we handle are as true to the South as anything can be found on the particular subject they deal with. When Brother Lloyd said he might host it this year, I volunteered to speak on John C. Calhoun. Not because I knew anything about him, but because I didn't know hardly anything about John C. Calhoun, except he was known as the great nullifier. And that's a wonderful doctrine. And I'm not going to deal with his political dealings today. First place, I do not know them well enough to deal with you about them. We're going to speak on his character and some of his beliefs. But nullification to me is a wonderful doctrine. Calhoun was not the originator, but he was the perfecter and the distiller and the codifier of the doctrine of nullification, which in essence was this, that the Constitution gave to the federal government some few, and they were few and limited powers. Now, the state, he said, had no right to supersede those powers that they conceded to the federal government as long as they were a part of the Union. But any time that the federal government sought to impose something upon the states outside of those limited powers, you know, for mutual protection, interstate commerce, dealing with foreign powers, anything outside of a few delegated powers that were given to the federal government, any time they passed some law that was not in those limited categories and a particular state did not agree with it, the people of that state didn't want it, they could declare it null and void and it wouldn't affect the people in that state. I like that. I don't know what you think about it, but I like it. I'm for it. I'll vote for it. I'll campaign for it. But he was much more than just the great nullifier. Three books I would recommend to you. There's not a lot in print on John C. Calhoun. There is, for those who want to devote much more time than most folks have, his papers are being published one volume at a time at the University of South Carolina. They're now up to about 26 or 7 volumes. And not many folks outside of some Calhoun scholars, and there are a few of those. In fact, I heard of one, and I've talked to some of them. I heard of one a couple of weeks ago, Mrs. Coit, C-O-I-T, who wrote this best biography on him, was telling me about a fellow Calhoun student, scholar, whom she said, after some years of being alone, married a woman much his junior with 2 small children, and he was going to adopt those 2 children. But she only stayed with him about a month and left with her children, and that was the end of that. And so she said to him, "What was the trouble?" He said, "Well, I think it was that I brought Calhoun home with me. He just lived with Calhoun, so he was so involved with him." But there are 3 books that are available. Here's a paperback that shows him as he was a very handsome young man, called John C. Calhoun, The Prince of Union, by Navin. It's put out by LSU. I don't think we have any of those left back there. This is the best biography, according to Dr. Wilson, the authority on Calhoun. It won a Pulitzer Prize and has recently been reissued by the University of South Carolina by Margaret Coit. John C. Calhoun, American Portrait. Beautifully written and warm to him. She likes him. She's an old lady in her 80s living up in New England. She was from North Carolina, but I don't fell from something or another, married a Yankee. And sounds like one on the phone. I called her and talked to her about it. And she said, "I hope I haven't lost," she said it as a New Englander, as a Massachusetts of all things, said it as they would say it almost. And she said, "I hope I haven't lost all of my Southern accent." I said, "I'm afraid that you pretty well have." She said, "Well, I lived with a damn Yankee a long time. It had a lot of effect on me." I'm quoting. Clyde Wilson did a great service. This is not a biography, but if you want to know Calhoun's political thinking, he, sort of like a Reader's Digest does with books, he did this condensing of Calhoun's work called The Essential Calhoun, in which he gives you some of his major statements, a condensed version of his 2 major works on the government, and parts from various speeches. And so if you want to know the political thinking of Calhoun and don't have time to wade through many, many volumes, I would recommend this to you. We have 4 or 5 copies back there if you want it. And you'll not find them in the bookstore. The strangest thing, these Yankees are, you know, there's some wonderful Yankees that have been converted by the grace of God. But they do some strange things up there in New England. The fellow that handles these books, a book dealer in Connecticut once again, doesn't even have a telephone number that you can give. I tried to call him the other day to order some more, and the operator said he doesn't have a listed number. I said, "Well, you said that so fast, you didn't even look it up." He said, "I don't have to look it up. Get calls for him all the time. And he has a telephone, but it's an unlisted number, and nobody can call him." I said, "Well, he's supposed to be a book dealer." Now, I know some of us book dealers are strange folks, but he said, "Well, I'm sorry. I can't give it out." So I had to write him and didn't get the extra ones that I wanted, but I didn't have time. But Anyway, I recommend it to you. My assignment was to find out whether Calhoun was a Christian or not. John Caldwell Colquhoun, he would have pronounced it. He would pronounce it as if it was an O, because he was seeking to preserve the Scottish pronunciation. The Calhouns were Scotch-Irish, as we call them today. As you know, that means they were Scots folks whose family had resided in the north of Ireland for a generation or two, or maybe longer, and then they came on to America and filled the valley up with Scotch-Irish. He was among those folks from both sides of his family that went on down to South Carolina before he was born. Brother Rumberg called Alexander Hamilton Stevens, he called Patrick Henry, the morning star of the Confederacy. Following that line of thinking, I would call Calhoun the rising sun of the Confederacy. He had a tremendous effect upon the political thought of this country for 40 years. From 1810 to 1850, anybody that wanted to get very much done on a national level must needs deal with John C. Calhoun. He never had a large political following. He didn't seek to build one. He was not a party man. He never controlled even the South in the sense of being able to make them all follow him. He was closer to that at his death than at any other time. But Southern folks are independent folks, and it's pretty hard to get them organized and behind any one movement. He was never successful in doing that. I don't know that he tried to do it very hard. But he was a force to be dealt with. He was recognized as a statesman. Dr. Rumberg has already given you that good definition of a statesman, as Dr. Wilson gave it in one of his address. And using that definition of a statesman who is concerned about the affairs of the state, above his own affairs and above any political party's affairs, a man that cannot be bought, a man that will not be persuaded by what is popular, a man that stands on principles and acts on what is right as he sees the right, and for the good of his country, is a statesman. And John C. Calhoun was a statesman. Many of those who did not agree with his political position of states' rights, individual freedom, for he gave his life to the study of the balance between power and freedom. A government that had enough authority to be what the government must needs be, and yet not have so much authority, so much power, that it did not infringe upon the freedom and liberty of the individual citizen. Now that was his life study. He was a brilliant man, a man of unusual intellect and knew much about many fields. He was an authority in the field of economics. And bankers and men who make their livelihood at that in Calhoun's day said that Calhoun understood national economics better than any of them did. He was authority in law. He studied law and would become a lawyer for a short time as a profession. And he knew his law and knew it well and was eminently successful in the short time that he practiced it. He was knowledgeable in theology. Many a preacher, seminary professor, theologian, over the course of those 40 years when Calhoun was in the public eye, went to him to seek to enlighten him upon some point of theology, only to come away saying, he knew more about it than I did. His love was farming. He loved to farm. He was reared on a farm. He acquired a farm, which is now Princeton University campus. At least I forget later, if you're down that way, Brother Rumberg suggested that you visit Washington, Georgia, where so many famous people did come from. Just a little way north of there is Abbeville, South Carolina, which I would suggest you also visit. But not far from there is Princeton University. And Princeton University, that 1,100 acres of Princeton University campus, was John C. Calhoun's plantation. His favorite daughter, the daughter that inherited his intellect and his love for statesmanship, married a fellow by the name of Clemson. And Clemson and his daughter in Clemson inherited the plantation, And when Clemson died, he left it to the state of South Carolina, along with his own fortune, which was sizable, with the stipulation that an agricultural college would be started within 2 years and would be called Clemson College. And so it was there on the plantation. So Calhoun's house is preserved right in the middle of the campus, right in the middle of the buildings of the campus is Fort Hill, his country home, not a mansion, but a respectable country home in which he lived so many years and which he loved so very much. Calhoun's favorite saying was, "Providence rules the world." He wrote two outstanding works on the government, either of which would be enough to give him a place in American history, and both of them were published after he died. A disquisition on government, its original form took up 107 pages, and secondly, a discourse on the Constitution and government of the United States. They both are given in somewhat abbreviated form in the Essential Calhoun. Down at Abbeville, South Carolina, I went through there in May. I spoke in Greenville at the memorial service of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. We had lived in Greenville for some years while we were in school there, but I'd never been to Abbeville. Used to want to go down there as a student because they had a place named Noah's Ark that had all kinds of books, but I never made it. When I had time, I didn't have any money. When I had any money, I didn't have the time, and so I never made it. But I finally did. Noah's Ark burned up, but Abbeville's still there. And it's a wonderful little town in which they're still proud of their Southern heritage. Confederate flags are found everywhere. When I got there in May, early May this year, it's built around a square, the town part is, and I was looking for the Confederate monument. A fellow was standing out in front of his antique store there, his hands in his pockets, wasn't any business going on, and I said, "Doesn't this town have a Confederate monument?" "Well, of course we do," he said. "Well," I said, "where is it?" He said, "right over," and then he stopped and said, well, I won't tell you just what he said, but he said something he shouldn't have said, and he said, "It's gone." There's a back hole over there digging. And I said, "Well, I thought that's where it ought to be, right in the center of the town." "Well," he said, "don't get excited about it." He said, it's gone because it was damaged in an unusual thing that I won't go into now. But it was damaged a couple of years ago. It was put there by the UDC, and the UDC chapter is still active in this town. There never was a question about what it was going to be replaced with one just like it. The only question was, who's going to pay for it? And they finally decided the city would pay for it. And so they had just taken the old one off that morning in preparation for bringing the supposedly exact reproduction of it and putting in its place. In that little town of Abbeville, settled by the Huguenots early in our history, in front of the city hall, there is a rather recent monument of rather modest proportions that reads, "Near here from 1807 to 1817 were situated the law offices of John C. Calhoun, born in the Long Canes district of Abbeville, March the 18th, 1782, the year of the American Revolution came to a close, 1782. Died Washington, D.C., March 31, 1850. Member of Congress, 1811 to 1817. Secretary of War, that was under James Monroe, 1817 to 1825. And by the way, the Monroe Doctrine, which we have all learned about in school, I trust and appreciated, would more accurately be called the Calhoun Doctrine, for he was the one that perfected that. Vice President of the United States, 1825 to 1832. He served under both John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson. Be hard to imagine two fellows more different. But in those days, the vice president was chosen separate from the president, and you had the same kind of conflict you sometimes that we had somewhat of in the Confederacy, as you heard about this morning. United States Senator, 1832 to 1842, and 1845 to 1850. Secretary of State, under Tyler, from 1844 to 1845. And he was eminent in all of those positions. Let's look a little bit at his beginning. Born the year the American Revolution ended, in the first frame house in the Long Cane district near Abbeville. By the way, if you go to Abbeville calls itself both the cradle and the grave of the Confederacy. It seems, you know, of course, that South Carolina was the first to secede. It seems that the first public meeting on secession in the Palmetto State was held at Abbeville. And the last cabinet meeting of the Confederate government, with President Davis and most of his cabinet present, met also in Abbeville. It was then that the members said to the president that it was useless to continue, and most of them went on their own way. Some stayed with him, and he was captured a couple of days later, so down in Irwinville, Georgia, as you know. And so if you go to Abbeville, be sure and visit the Burke Starr Mansion, which is preserved, and the furnishings are supposed to be the original in which that cabinet meeting was held. Also, you'll want to visit Trinity Episcopal Church. It's a beautiful old building. The congregation itself is about played out, but they're trying to keep it up. And it has this magnificent tall window behind the altar, a beautiful stained glass window. I thought it rather strange that nobody's there, but you can just walk in, you know. I thought it rather strange that that window came all the way down to the floor behind the altar. And as I was coming out, I met a lady who had taken me through the mansion. She was down there seeing about some business in a store building nearby. And I remarked to her something about that window. She said, "There's a wonderful story about that window. Trinity Episcopal Church was built in 1860, completed just before the war, except for the window. They had to order that from England. And it took some time to get it. It was supposed to be a window that portrayed the Trinity. This one portrays Christ as the Good Shepherd." And she said it came in through the blockade into Charleston. They loaded it in sections, boxed up and crated up, in wagons, and brought it over the rough roads to Abbeville, laid it out on the front lawn, uncrated it, and found it to be an altogether different window and considerably longer than the one they'd ordered. But it was magnificent, and there was no chance to get a second one when the war was on, so they just went in and tore out enough bricks and fixed the thing to fit. And so it stayed. She said it was years after, several years after the war was over, that they found out that some Episcopal cathedral in Boston had also ordered a window from the same company, and in the packing, they got switched, and they got the cathedral's window, and the cathedral got their window. She said, "We have considered mounting a raid and going and getting it, but I think they decided otherwise on that." Calhoun was born into a Puritan, Calvinistic family. Scotch-Irish, as we've mentioned. Self-discipline and self-control were emphasized. They settled down to that little Huguenot community, as did many other of the Scotch-Irish that came into South Carolina before the American Revolution. Another of Calhoun's often repeated statements was, "Life is a struggle against evil." He was taught that as a youngster, and he believed that all of his life. His father was Patrick Calhoun, as was his grandfather, and he had a brother and a son by that same name. But his father was rather prominent in local politics before the Revolution, under the Crown, and after the Revolution. He represented his area in the state assemblies. He was opposed politically to the aristocrats of Charleston and surrounding area, the big planters, for he was not a big planter, he was a farmer. He owned more slaves than anybody in their district, 31 of them, but he didn't have an overseer, nor did anybody around there have an overseer. Those would come in sometime later, but he worked in the field with his servants. And the family worked in the home and in the gardens and did all their work right beside their servants. And so he opposed the aristocrats and their politics, as Calhoun was supposed to do so later on in his own political career. His father had fought in the American Revolution, told many stories about it. And so Calhoun was brought up in the atmosphere of what these men fought for, as did many of their neighbors, were veterans of the Revolutionary War. They were Indian fighters. The savages were still in the frontier. And his father told many stories of them and referred to them as savages. They feared a strong central government. They believed in local self-government. And that was greatly emphasized, what we were fighting for. Calhoun is the son of Patrick's second marriage, his first wife having died. Calhoun's mother was Martha Caldwell, who is remembered as being a tall, graceful, cultured, well-mannered lady. Not a Southern belle, not an aristocrat who stayed at the house and gave all the orders, for she worked hard herself, but she was a cultured, refined, devout lady who taught her son a love for the scriptures. Mrs. Coate, in her biography, said there was much else that Martha Caldwell taught her son. From her, he learned to reverence the Bible as sacred, and although never religious in the orthodox sense, he was always devout. She taught him to revere God, to honor his parents, and to do justice. And these were lessons that remained with him, just as his father's theories of government became a part of his being. Well, there wasn't much opportunity for education. It was a frontier. He had learned to read and write at a local log cabin school. But as he was about 12 years of age, 12 or 13, a Presbyterian preacher came through trying to find a place to minister and was interested in establishing a school somewhere. You heard his name mentioned yesterday. How closely some of these heroes tie together. He was a young preacher by the name of Moses Waddell, later to be president of the University of Georgia, but then a young upstart Presbyterian preacher. Waddell was invited to stay at the Calhoun home, which he accepted. He was much struck by his first day there by John C.'s older sister, Catherine. Lovely young lady, eligible. Waddell said later on that the first night he stayed there, he had a dream about her. He dreamed she would marry him. And then he said he also dreamed that night that she would not live long after the marriage. And he was troubled by the dream. I don't know how soon he told her. I think he had enough sense not to wake up the next morning and tell it. But he did tell it later on. Well, his dream came true. For whatever it meant, he did marry her with the family's blessing. They were impressed, the young Waddell. And he married Catherine, and they moved down in just over into Georgia, into Columbia County, Georgia, and he started an academy out there on the frontier. He had a pretty good library for his time and circumstances, and he was a brilliant fellow, Waddell. And John C. Calhoun went along to learn, too. In a few months, Catherine took sick and died. Waddell was overcome with grief. He dismissed the school, sent all the students home except John C., and left John C. in his own home with his library while he himself, thinking that it would help him to overcome his grief, went off on an extended preaching tour. Now, Calhoun was only 13 years old, left out on the frontier by himself. He'd been raised on the frontier. He could take care of himself. But like most 13-year-old boys, he wasn't much on cooking, and he didn't eat very well. Seems rather strange that he didn't send him home, too, but he didn't. But the advantage to it all was that Calhoun devoured his library while he was away. He read everything he'd get his hands on, including some pretty heavy works. He read Roland's multi-volume history. He read The Human Understanding by John Locke. And, of course, Moses Waddell's library was heavy on theology, and we assume that he read a great deal of those books on doctrine. When Waddell finally came back home, he was alarmed at young Calhoun's poor physical appearance. He had not been eating as he ought to have been, and he never was heavy. He was always rather thin, and so he was so alarmed about it that he took him home. But about the same time, and just before he got home, his father died, Patrick. So he came home to a widowed mother, and she needed him. She nursed him back to health, and he took over the running of the 5 farms and 31 slaves. He had a younger brother, a year or two younger than he, and those two boys. He had 2 older brothers, too, but they'd already gone out on their own, and for some reason they did not come home at that time, or did not come home and stay. And so young Calhoun had the running of that farm, and he delighted in it, and he was good at it. And he worked hard out in the fields along beside his servants. He would love farming all of the days of his life. He loved to be at Fort Hill. He'd rather be there than Washington, D.C. any time, though he was usually away. Well, his intellect was so apparent to all who knew him that the Scotch-Irish neighbors, and they were strong on education. Now, listen, you don't need to swallow this cracker culture foolishness that's going about, that the Southern forebears were a bunch of sops that sat around and drank and caroused and were just a bunch of scoundrels. I want to tell you that plenty of our ancestors, and my ancestors no better than yours, we all got all kinds of them, you know. I spoke at a UDC chapter one time over the mountain in the aristocratic part of Birmingham, and everybody there claimed to be a descendant of a general. When I got up to speak, I said, "Where are your private ancestors?" One little old lady back there who was more truthful than she was politically correct to that group, I guess, said, "Oh, we all got plenty of them. We just don't talk about them." Down the valley here, about 50 miles, where Timber Ridge Presbyterian Church is, some of my ancestors helped start that church. The pastor of that church started a school, and they're still fighting Indians. I had a grandmother get killed by Indians on the way home from that church. They started the church in 1746, 250 years ago. And while they were still carrying guns to the church and school for protection from the Indians, in that little academy that they started, which later became Liberty Hall, which later became Washington College, which later became Washington Lee University, that little country school taught by that one man was teaching Greek and Latin and other subjects so that normal subjects we would expect them to teach, so that they could read and understand the Word of God. That's not cracker culture. Well, hurrying on, Calhoun was so intelligent, his neighbors, who the Scotch-Irish folks, said, "Miss Calhoun, you've got to send this boy to school. He's too smart to be a farmer." One farmer said, I went by the fields of the Calhoun, one of their farms, and I saw John C. out there plowing, just whistling and plowing, with a plow behind a team of horses, and he had a book tied to the plow and was reading the book as he was whistling and plowing. Well, Miss Calhoun was for education, but she needed the boy rather badly. So she sent for the two older brothers and said, "You come home. We need to do a little counseling here and see what we could do." Well, the two brothers did come home for that meeting, and they said they got together and they said, "John C., you need to go to school. You have a wonderful mind, and we want to educate you." He'd had 2 years now under Waddell. That's all he'd had. John said, "No, I want to farm. I want to be." I said, "I don't want an education. I don't want to be a." They want him to be a lawyer. He said, "I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be a planner." Well, they stayed with him and debated with him. And let me read you the account from Mrs. Coates' biography. It was these two brothers, shop clerks in Augusta and Charleston, who, as instruments of Providence, diverted their stubborn, sober-eyed younger brother from his peaceful existence to the rocky road of politics. Had not James and William returned to the family farms while John was still young enough for formal education, he might have only been remembered as a neighborhood individualist. Already he had become set in his habits of living. This was no child. Now he's 18 years old at the time. This was no child James and William had to deal with, but a man who had found his place in the world and was content. This was the self-assured master of the plantation. His lips above a cleft, square chin, set with a firmness startling to one so young. Tentatively, the two brothers approached the question. Moses Wydell had reopened his school. John could go back there for a few months to sit him to practice law. John shook his head. He could not think of leaving his mother, he said, and he did not want to be a lawyer. He had determined to be a planner. A planner he would remain. To convince him of the necessity of his own education was even more difficult than winning over his mother had been. But his brothers persisted. They put a far higher estimate upon his abilities than he did himself. At last John gave way. Yes, if his mother gave her free consent, he would return to school. but he would not be contented with a few months. He faced the family council with an ultimatum. Now think of this, 18-year-old lad facing the family with this ultimatum. To a partial education, I answer decidedly no. But if you are willing and able to give me a complete education, I give my consent. What's your idea of a complete education? The best school, college, and legal education to be had in the United States, John replied. In that case, we'll be obligated to send you to a New England college and maintain you there for several years. True, but I will accept nothing less. How long will you require for the accomplishment of such an education? About 7 years. John himself chose Yale College. Well, he entered Yale at those tender years of only 24 months of intensive study under Waddell. He was a little fearful on whether a man with such a disadvantage in formal education could hold his own among those other Yale students. But his fears soon dissipated. His first class that he went to that he met was a math class. And of course, in those days, no tablets. Everybody wrote on a slate, and everybody had a slate. And so the professor wrote the problem on the slate at the front of the blackboard at the front of the room, and told them to proceed to figure it out. John C. sat there and figured it out and handed his slate in long before anybody else. The professor looked at it. To his astonishment, it was correct. Next problem that was put up, same thing. This happened over and over again that day. He finished before everybody else, and he was right every time. Calhoun was not proud and haughty, but that did give him some confidence that he was going to be able to hold his own. In fact, he graduates ahead of his class and was chosen to give an address at the graduation. Now, another interesting fellow whom many of you know about and have read of and have some of his books was president of Yale at that time. He had done much to bring the college back into a Christian, the stance of a Christian college. His name was Timothy Dwight, the son-in-law of Jonathan Edwards. He was teaching, his college was small. He not only was president, but he taught a lot of the classes also. The attendance at chapel and prayer meeting were both compulsory. Calhoun was much impressed by Timothy Dwight, as Dwight was greatly impressed by him. Many years later, when Calhoun, as the holding a national office, would meet the illustrious Southern theologian James Henley Thornwell, Calhoun would say of Thornwell, "He has the greatest mind of any man I've ever met since Timothy Dwight." And it is recorded by some of the historians of and biographers of Thornwell, as well as those of Calhoun, that they became fast friends, Thornwell and Calhoun, and that they loved to walk over the fields of South Carolina together discussing theology. Calhoun was much impressed that Thornwell not only knew theology, but he too knew a lot about a lot of other subjects. Dwight was a strong Federalist in his political thinking, but that never affected Calhoun. It didn't rub off on him. But he would say that old Pope Dwight, as some of the students were prone to call him, did have a profound effect upon his thinking. While he was there and near his graduation, Calhoun's beloved mother died, and he grieved for her greatly. In fact, he grieved for her so much that he became sick. In that illness in New England, far away from family and loved ones, he received a note from a cousin's widow, a wealthy lady from Charleston, who spelled their family name with an O instead of an A to help preserve the original pronunciation. A very wealthy woman that had three children and made quite an entourage of going from Charleston to New England every summer to spend the summers up there. She would go in the spring and return to Charleston in the fall. She herself had her own carriage in which she and the children rode. Their carriage men were dressed in full uniform, followed by numerous wagon loads of materials and food and things they would need to make that long trip, along with wagon loads of servants to wait on them when they got there. But the interesting thing about her was that she not only had this high standing and helped Calhoun politically with the Boston aristocrats, I mean the Charleston aristocrats when he would run for office, but she was a serious and devout and active Christian and witnessed often to Calhoun and his wife and encouraged them to be more active in the Lord's work. Well, she sent him a note and said, come down and visit us at our summer home, which was just a little ways away. He did. And there he met his future wife, Miss Calhoun's daughter, Floride, who was a distant cousin. And though he, like his father, had an aversion for those Charleston aristocrats, he didn't mind paying court to one and later marrying one. When he finished Yale, he didn't get to give his address, but his address was because of his sickness at Yale, but his address was entitled The Qualifications Necessary to Make a Statesman. Well, after that, he went to a famous law school at Litchfield, Connecticut, under Judge Reeves, which he learned much. Reeves, too, was a strong Federalist. Again, I did not affect Calhoun's thinking on that particular line. He went back to Charleston and passed the bar and then went up to Abbeville, hung out his shingle, and practiced law for a little while. He did very well, but he didn't like it. And so he decided he'd run for Congress, and he got elected. That was in 1810. But just before the war, we were having trouble with Great Britain. The War of 1812 was beginning to come on. Congress was reluctant to do anything, and the president was reluctant to do anything, and Calhoun, a young upstart from South Carolina, got the Congress fired up and got them behind the war effort and was largely responsible for the United States giving that resistance to Great Britain. There were some other famous men that would be in Congress during Calhoun's time, the better known of which is Daniel Webster of New England, Henry Clay of Kentucky, whom Calhoun said was more style than he was substance. There was John Quincy Adams, with whom he had some respect for, but of course differed tremendously from him. And Andrew Jackson, he would later serve under him. But there was also a fellow from here in Virginia that many of you are much more familiar with than I am, John Randolph of Roanoke. And I think he was a good man, as best I know, and stood right on the issues. But Roanoke dominated the House of Congress, House of Representatives, and nobody dared take him on. He was such a fierce and strong and dominating debater that he had almost all of them intimidated and cowed down. So this young upstart Calhoun took him on over something over the question of the War of 1812, and he not only took him on, but he was successful in out-debating him and putting him down. And it made a tremendous hit in the Congress. Some said a great spirit has come amongst us. This young man, John Quincy Adams, said, is someone who's going to be heard from later. And so he got off to, it may be a rocky, but a good start, and his brilliance became very apparent. It was Clay, I believe, who would call him the last Roman. Some have referred to him as the last of the founding fathers. He doesn't quite fit the time chronologically, but his thoughts and his thinking and his ideas of what government ought to be were those of our founding fathers. Well, time is hurrying on, isn't it? What is it, 10 of 12? I thought I heard some stomachs growling out there or something. I don't want to be too long. But just trying to define Calhoun for you, let me tell you what he was not. Sometimes that helps. He was not the Iron Man, as you hear him referred to. That was written by a British female author who never met Americans she liked, and she met Calhoun one time, and she dubbed him the Iron Man. It stuck with him, but it's unfair. He was warm and compassionate, easy to approach. I could give you a number of examples of that, but perhaps the best example was that when Calhoun was at home at Fort Hill and would come out and walk down among the quarters of the servants, the Negro quarters, not only his own children, he had 10, not only they were surrounding him and holding on to him and playing with him, but the little colored children would roll out of those cabins and they'd play with the old master too. Now that's not an Iron Man. They didn't fear to approach him and play with him and have some fun with him. And he delighted in it. He was a warm, friendly man. You would like him. You would find him easy to talk to. He was not that ugly-looking, wild-haired man most of his life that you see pictures of. When he was in his last sickness, it was rather prolonged sickness, his favorite daughter, the one that married Clemson, she could get him to do almost anything she wanted, and she begged him to go to it and have his photograph made, and which he did, in which he appears something like old John Brown, with a wild look, you know, because he was so sick, and he was really a gentleman, as this picture on this one of these books will show. He was not, as you sometimes hear, rather foolishly said, he was not the father of Abraham Lincoln. Some try to explain how Lincoln got his brains that way, I understand. And Lincoln's parentage was somewhat in doubt, and so they try to say he was, and some even say he looked like each other, but compare the pictures, you'll find out that he was not, did not look like each other. He was not a Unitarian, as some try to make him. He did give $10 to a friend who was soliciting funds to build the Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C. Now, I don't think he ought to have done that, but he did do that, and that's a matter of record. And I think it is also a matter of record that they put everybody that gave anything towards the building of that church on their church roll. But he was not a Unitarian. He did not attend the Unitarian Church. He never said he was a Unitarian. But some people do say that he was, of course. He was not a joiner. About the only thing that we know that he joined, as well as far as organizations are concerned, was a local farmers association in Pendleton, South Carolina, was organized, and he did join that and went to it when he was home. He was not a party man. Quoting from one of his biographies, it is said, the truth is, quoting Calhoun, that he wrote in a public letter, he said, the truth is that I have not been able, with my principles and policy, to act with either party, except occasionally for the last 17 years. I differ from both on several important questions, and among others, the prescriptive policy of turning opponents out of office indiscriminately and bestowing their places as rewards for partisan services on the least meritoriousness of the respective parties, and agree with each in some particulars. Mine has been an independent course throughout, and hence I have been compelled to separate from the party in power and act with those out of power during the long period mentioned. I have never separated from the weak to join the strong, but from the strong to join the weak. That takes a statesman, you know. He was not an anti-unionist. He loved the Union. He spent most of his life trying to preserve the Union. And up until the last few months of his life, thought that they might be able to preserve the Union and have states' rights too. In the last months of his life, he was convinced that they would have to leave the Union to maintain their freedom. He was not a man who could be bought or sold. Personal wealth did not greatly interest him. He hated debt and wanted the government to be out of debt. But when he died, he still owed some money on Fort Hill. He had never made a lot of money. In fact, he left Congress to become Secretary of War, and that paid considerably less than the member of the Senate paid, as did the Vice President. He never let money decide for him what he would do. It was interesting, he was held in such high esteem by the South Carolinians that those, particularly in Charleston, when they heard he was sick, had gotten up a purse to buy him a yacht. They thought it would help restore his health. They collected $10,000. That was a lot of money then. And he died before the yacht was purchased, so they gave it to Miss Calhoun, and she paid off the debt on Fort Hill with that $10,000. He was not a man who was willing to sacrifice character or principle for the office of presidency or any other office. He, writing to a friend, said, as to myself, I have seen enough to place very little value on what is called popularity and have but little desire for power. To discharge my public duties under every difficulty with fidelity or intelligence and to stand with a fair character in after times is about the height of my ambition. He would write to another friend, it is ever better to be defeated in a good cause than not to make the effort to maintain it. To another he would write, it is better, in my opinion, to be defeated maintaining the true and the right than to secede on any other ground. That's a kindred spirit to General Lee, is it not? After the war, General Lee was asked, if you knew then what you know now, would you still fight? Did you ever think we'd win? General Lee said, I never considered that. The question was not whether we would win or lose. The question was, were we right or wrong, I would not change my course of action had I to do over again. And so it was with Calhoun and his thinking. He would write to his daughter, Anna Marie, his favorite daughter, "You must not suppose that in contending against corruption and interest that I am impelled by the hope of success. Had that been the case, I would long since have retired from the conflict. Far higher motives impel me, a sense of duty to do our best for our country and leave the rest to Providence. I hold the duties of life to be greater than life itself, and that in performing them manfully, even against hope, our labor is not lost, but will be productive of good in after times. Indeed, I regard this life very much as a struggle against evil, and that to him who acts on proper principle, the reward is in the struggle more than in the victory itself." Although that greatly enhances it, so strong is my faith in this belief, my dear daughter, that no appreciation of my efforts, either by the present or after times, is necessary to sustain me in struggling to do my duty in resisting wrong, especially where our country is concerned. Now, that was a private letter to a daughter. Wasn't trying to impress anybody. Wasn't trying to get votes on it. Just telling how he really felt. So we have many others, and we'll skip those quotes for the sake of time. When Calhoun was old and sickly, he chose Jefferson Davis as his successor. One of his biographers suggested that was not a wise choice, because they said Mr. Davis had a love for the Union as Calhoun did. If he had chose Rhett from Charleston, who was already ready to break with the Union, we might have broke with the Union in 1850 and probably would have been successful. Well, that's an interesting thought. That's no reflection against Mr. Davis, who was indeed a very great man. To quote Lee again, somebody asked Lee after the war, "What do you think of Davis as president?" He said, "Well, no man could have done better, and few could have done as well." And so I'll just take Myers Roberts' word on it. We come to the question, was Calhoun a Christian? We've seen his childhood and upbringing in a Puritan home. We've observed his education under Waddell and Dwight. He regularly attended either the Episcopal or the Presbyterian Church. He himself seems to have preferred the Presbyterian Church. His wife, with her aristocratic upbringing and a long member of an active member of the Episcopal Church, preferred that. She liked its ritual, and they're usually more elaborate buildings. When they were home at Fort Hill, Calhoun liked to go to the little plain Presbyterian Church. But Ms. Calhoun started an Episcopal Church largely through her own efforts at Pendleton, nearby town. And she went there. So he sometimes went there, and then he would go to the Presbyterian Church. But he went regularly and listened intently. When he first went to Charleston as a young man, he was shocked and dismayed at the disregard of that metropolis for the Lord's Day, for he was used to observing the Lord's Day. His life, private and public, was one of uprightness and purity. He did not cuss. He did not drink. He did not gamble. He did not assume any of those habits that were so common among the other great men that were in Congress in his time. His sexual morals were above question. He was separated from his wife much of the time. His mother-in-law had bought a beautiful, magnificent estate in Georgetown for them to live in. But the climate was so that it didn't agree with the children's health. And so after trying that for a rather short time, Ms. Calhoun decided to go home to South Carolina, to Fort Hill, for the children's sake. And so he was separated from his family. And he lived very plainly in a boarding house all the time that he was up there. A story, I think, that would prove that he was not a Unitarian. Who ever heard of a Unitarian doing this? It's an interesting story. When he was at home one time, a stranger came through, as they often did, horseback, traveling somewhere, and he stopped and asked if he could be put up for the night. That was not uncommon. Calhoun, of course, offered him the hospitality of the Calhoun home. And after supper that night, he, of course, had a servant take the horse to the barn and feed it and curry it and feed it. And after supper that night, They went to the parlor, and Calhoun called the family for their regular nightly devotions. The stranger, the visitor, the traveler, declined, said he didn't believe in that sort of thing. He wouldn't join the family for devotions. Calhoun's eyes flashed, and he said to the servant, "Saddle his horse." I don't know where that fellow stayed that night, but it wasn't the Calhoun home. Miss Cart said of Calhoun, he had a deep interest in religion. More than one historian has agreed with a contemporary journalist who asserted that, born a century earlier, Calhoun might have been the Jonathan Edwards of the South. Now, people, unsaved people, say that sort of thing, and, you know, God's got to regenerate a man and call a man, and they don't understand that. They just think about his intellect there, I think, and the fact that he, even his writings on government are so philosophical that they think he would that his mind was in many ways turned in the same way of Jonathan Edwards, but he was not a preacher, Calhoun. He would never join a church. Blameless as his life appeared to be, conscientious scruples troubled him, and he held back from a conviction of his personal unfitness. His pastors, numerous ones over the years, however, had no doubts as to his piety, so says Ms. Cott, and I'm not sure that what her spiritual understanding is. And one who discussed religion with him was astonished to find him better informed than himself on those very points where he had expected to give him information. His manner was reverent in church, and friends thought him much disturbed by any attention in others. But he had his lapses. Charles Cotsworth Pinckney, who was the pastor at the Episcopal Church that Miss Calhoun had founded, from the famous Pinckney family, was startled one Sunday to look up from his sermon and find Calhoun with his eyes closed. I don't know why that startled a preacher. Apparently asleep or absorbed in his own thoughts, the rector smiled. "You're counting electoral votes," he thought to himself. "You've not heard a word." After the service, the pastoral coach stopped to pick up the long-legged statesman who was already well into his four-mile walk home. You wonder how well I'm bad he wanted to attend church. He walked 4 miles to go to church. Scarcely had Calhoun sat down in his coach when he leaped full-armed into the rector's sermon, discussed it, disputed it, took it apart point by point. He was an intensive Bible student. The Hebrew people fascinated him, their origin, their history, and their race. He even longed to study their language, and he developed a theoretical grammar of Hebrew himself. He is said to have believed the biblical prophecies and studied them greatly. When Calhoun was on his deathbed, the news of the great South Carolinian was on his deathbed, sent the young Senate chaplain, C.M. Butler, aflame with evangelistic zeal, hurrying to Hill's boarding home to bring his restless soul before God. Through a half-open doorway, he caught a glimpse of the sick man, pale, emaciated, his head propped by pillows, his eyes piercing and restless as ever. Calhoun would not see him. He was unbending on that, almost angry. "I won't be told what to think," he exclaimed. "Religion was a subject I've thought on all my life." Robert Barnwell Rhett went to see him on his deathbed and urged upon him the necessity of trusting Christ as his Savior. Calhoun did not respond either for or against. He just listened and said nothing. Now, Ms. Cox says of his death, and she's not a Calvinist herself, I don't believe, but here's what she says. "Now, with his days drawing to a close, the stern old Calvinistic doctrines of his youth once more reasserted their power. He was stirred by the revival of Presbyterianism through the southern states, And to those who knew him best, it seemed that his doubts had at last been resolved. Dr. Venerable questioned him about the time and manner in which best to meet death. And he answered with the old-time faith of his boyhood. Quote, "I have little concern about either. I desire to die in the discharge of my duty. I have an unshaken reliance upon the providence of God." And so I leave that with you. Was he a Christian? I don't know. He had the life of a Christian ought to have. He knew theology. But the fact remains, we must not make man something he was not, the fact remains that he never made a public profession of faith in Christ Jesus. He lived a more quote-unquote Christian life than the average church member lived. But we all know that that does not save you. The Lord must save you. We are saved by faith. And he never expressed publicly, as far as we can find, and I talked with Dr. Wilson, the authority on him. I talked with Mrs. Cott. I have read a great deal about him. No authority on him. And he just never said what he believed as far as relationship with Christ. And so he's long been in the hands of the Lord. It was 1850 that he died. And a just God does what's right, of course. But I would say this to you, though he was not be called a great Christian, in fact, if he was a Christian, we ought to have an appreciation for his tremendous stand and effect that he had in bringing his people, not only of South Carolina, but of the South, to the understanding of the essential necessity of the right of local self-government, of states' rights, that if we're going to have freedom in the land, we must be vigilant and we must battle against a strong, central, despotic government getting ever stronger and meddling in the affairs of our life on every level. He was a champion of freedom, a champion of liberty, gave his life to the defense of the South. And a Southerner that's not grateful for that is a sad Southerner, in my opinion. So he was a great statesman, and indeed could be said, I think, the rising sun of the Confederacy. Thank you for putting up with me for a long time. God bless you.